Okay, we made it up to slide six last time. I haven't talked about this yet. What we're looking at is how inheritance works for a heritable genetic disorder. Not all genetic disorders are heritable, of course, like cancer, for instance. Genetic disorder simply means it's some disorder of the genes, and cancer fits that bill. But heritable disorders are disorders that get inherited from parents. And the symbology here is that, not only is this a heritable disorder we're looking at, but it's a heritable disorder that is sex-linked. It's caused by a gene that is sex-linked, as we've talked about last time. And so you have the genders of the parents indicated here, but a white background box means a totally normal person with respect to that gene. A light red box means that the person does not have the disorder but is a carrier. And fully red means that that person has the disorder. And these aren't all the possibilities. This just shows you three possibilities with respect to combinations of parents. So a female, since it's a sex-linked gene, it acts like an autosome for her, remember. She has two X chromosomes. So she has two alleles for the gene that can cause the disorder, but only if you have the mutant allele. Well, she's totally normal. Capital N means normal version. And he is an affected individual. So his only allele for this gene is the mutant one that causes the disorder. That's why he has it. If those two parents have offspring, what the Punnett square shows you is that all of the females will be carriers. None of them will have the disorder because all of them will have one dominant allele, which will keep them from having the disorder. But if they reproduce, they can pass, possibly, an allele that causes the disorder to their children. And what it shows you is that all of the sons, however many they have, will be totally normal, which makes sense because a male has to get his X chromosome from his mother, right? He gets his Y chromosome from his father, he gets his X chromosome from his mother, and she was totally normal. In the middle example, you have a carrier female, a mother, and a totally normal father. Well, what the Punnett square says here is that half of the females will be totally normal, half of the daughters. Half of the daughters will be carriers, but none of them will actually have the disorder. Well, none of the daughters. Half of the sons, though, however many there are, will have the disorder, half will not, and half will be totally normal. The third one is the most risky of the situations. If you have a carrier female and a male that actually has it, it's not as risky as both mother and father have the disorder. But if she's a carrier and he has it, then half of the daughters will have it, half will be carriers, and no daughters will be normal. The only normal possibilities will be half of the sons, the others will have the disorder. And it would work differently, of course, if there are genetic disorders that are not sex-linked. They're autosomal, and those will work more conventionally. Okay, now on to seven, using this cat example. This also has to do with sex-linked genes or sex-linked characteristics. If you have a sex-linked gene, remember, that means that, and we're talking about members or animals that use the XY system, which includes not only humans and fruit flies, as we said, but actually all mammals, including cats. They use the same system we do. And so in the XY system, a female is going to have two alleles for a sex-linked gene, as we discussed, whereas a male will have only one, right? Because he has only one X chromosome and there is no gene of that type on the Y chromosome. So this brings up the idea of dosage compensation. Now, dosage here, which refers to how much you get, right? Dosage means the dosage of the alleles for this gene. And it doesn't it's not an issue for an autosome because dosage is equal for males and females. But a female in the XY system gets a double dose of a sex-linked gene with respect to allele. She has two alleles, whereas a male has only half, one dose. He has half the dose compared to her, in other words. So there have been various ways that evolution has worked to make things more equal. It's an inequity to have different dosages, and therefore there is dosage compensation mechanisms that have evolved. Now, if you think about this just as a problem, there's two ways you could go about solving this dosage inequity of dosage. One way would be to bring the males up to the level of the females somehow, and the other would be to bring the females down to the level of the males somehow. And both of those things have evolved in different species. But the one that we're looking at here is solved by bringing the females down to the level of the males. In the way that happens is called X chromosome inactivation, which is exactly what the phrase says it is. A female has two X chromosomes, therefore if you inactivate one of those two, then a female will have the same number of alleles for each of those X-linked genes as a male will. That's the idea here. The example uses fur color in cats, and there are two alleles here, orange fur allele and black fur allele. And what we have here is a female cat, because it only works for females. X chromosome inactivation only occurs in females, obviously, right? You wouldn't want to inactivate the only X chromosome that a male has, or it would kill it. But anyway, a female cat, of course, can be either homozygous or heterozygous. If she's homozygous, it doesn't matter which X chromosome gets inactivated, right? Because she'll have two of the same allele. But if she's heterozygous, which this example is, then it does matter which X chromosome gets inactivated. Which X chromosome gets inactivated, by the way, occurs randomly. All right? One of them gets turned off. The whole chromosome does, not just a gene. The whole chromosome gets highly condensed, just like it does in preparation for cell division that we talked about, only for the entire lifetime of the cells, for the entire lifetime of that organism. So those genes are there, but they're just inaccessible. It's the same as not actually having that extra X. Well, the weirdness that comes into play here is, well, let me just say that if X chromosome inactivation occurred at the single cell stage, when it's a zygote, when the cat is a zygote still, just one cell big, then it would be like flipping a coin. It's permanent, by the way. It's not just for the lifetime of that cell. Whichever X chromosome gets inactivated, the same one will be inactivated in the two cells that it splits into, and so on. So if it happened at the one-celled stage, that means it would affect the entire body of the cat that would develop from that one zygote. And therefore, the cat would either be purely orange or purely black, depending on which way the coin flipped, depending on which of the two X chromosomes gets inactivated, in other words. But it doesn't happen at the one-celled stage. It does happen in early embryonic development. So it's not very many cells big yet when this X chromosome inactivation happens, but it's more than one cell. And the thing is that there are hundreds of cells at this point in this very early embryo, and each one of those hundreds of cells flips its own coin as to which of the X chromosomes gets inactivated, and then it will be permanent for all of the progeny cells that cell gives rise to after cell division. And therefore, what we have in this case, for a female who is a heterozygote, is that she is a mosaic. A mosaic in art is right, something that's a mishmash of different things. It's, a female here is called a mosaic because there are certain parts of her body that'll have one trait, certain other parts that will have the other trait. And the reason this happens is because when you just imagine a ball of cells, an early embryo, doesn't look like a cat yet, but it will develop into a cat. Each of those cells in that ball will flip a coin and become either black is on or orange is on and the other one is off. And even though it's just a ball of cells, where a cell is in that early embryo corresponds to the body part that it will develop into, the region. So, depending on the randomness, that corresponding part will be orange or black in the adult. And that's why we have this. You don't find male cats with this pattern, or it's not really a pattern, it's random, because they have only one allele to begin with. You don't inactivate any X chromosome in a male. By the way, it's obvious to look at this, she's a mosaic. But there are a human example of this exists as well, with the ability to freely sweat, which you can't really tell by looking at a person unless you look at the skin very close with the microscope. But there can be mosaic females with the ability to freely sweat, and parts of her skin will freely sweat, parts right next to it will not be able to. All right, let's go to 8. These flies are used to illustrate something we've talked a little bit about already, but hopefully this will make sense. Notice that this is a dihybrid cross because there are two genes and correspondingly two characteristics being traced here. One is body color, which there are two alleles for, either black or gray, and the gray is the dominant type. So B here stands for black, but if you're actually gray, it's B plus, the wild type. Okay, B plus means gray. And the other characteristic is wing shape. A normal full-sized wing is dominant, and these very small, reduced in size wings are called vestigial wings. That's the mutant trait. So VG stands for vestigial, but VG plus means actually a full wing. And she, this fly on the left here, is homozygous dominant for both of the two traits. Homozygous dominant for body color and for wing shape. This one is doubly homozygous, but homozygous recessive. Black winged, BB, and vestigial, black bodied, and vestigial winged, BG, VG. Okay, so this is just another example. There's nothing new about this. It shouldn't surprise you that if you do cross these two, then every one of the F1s will have the same appearance, right? Each one of them will have the dominant color and the dominant wing shape because it's complete dominance. All of the F1s will be double heterozygotes, B plus B, VG plus VG. No surprise there either, nothing new. Now this test cross that's being done here is done for a different reason, but notice that what we're doing in this test cross is taking an F1, instead of crossing it with another F1, which we do to produce the F2, like we've talked about, an F1 is crossed with another doubly homozygous recessive individual, black-bodied and vestigial wing. And then we look at the offspring. Well, this doubly homozygous recessive test cross parent can make only one kind, he's the male, can make only one kind of sperm, right? You're going to choose a B and a VG no matter what. So that's why there's only one row in the Punnett square. But this F1 member, who is a double heterozygote, can make four different kinds of eggs, all combinations of B, B+, V, and VG+. So that's these eggs. And therefore, there are four possible zygotes that are predicted by the Punnett square, right? Okay, that's just background information. That should already make sense to you. or I mean, it should make sense to you based on what we've already said. But let's look at these predicted ratios down here. There are two different hypotheses being tested here. This says if genes are located on different chromosomes. Okay, so that's one hypothesis, that the genes are, there's two genes involved, right? Each gene is on its own chromosome. They're not on the same chromosome. The other possibility, the other hypothesis, is that they're located on the same chromosome. So this brings up another definition, which is linkedness. And don't be confused by this word, because we've talked about sex-linked already, right? Sex-linked is a phrase that can apply, I mean, does apply to just a single gene. In other words, it makes sense to think of a single gene as either being sex-linked or not. Because all sex-linked means is that that one gene is on a sex chromosome. Well, sex-linked and linked are two totally different things. When we use linked by itself, it doesn't make sense to talk about one gene. Instead, you have to be talking about a pair of genes at least. Usually it's just two, but it could be more than two. If we say that two genes are linked, that simply means that they occur on the same chromosome, whether it's an autosome or a sex chromosome. They're just passengers on the same chromosome. Okay, so that's what the two possibilities are here. And that's the only two possibilities, right? If you consider two genes, they have to be on chromosomes somewhere. The only two possibilities is that they're on different chromosomes, they're unlinked, or they're on the same chromosome, they are linked. Well, if they're linked, or if they're not linked, which is this first predicted ratio, then you would expect all four of these possible phenotypic combinations in the zygotes. All of these should be possible. Therefore, the predicted ratio of however many offspring there are, it should be 1 to 1 to 1 to 1. There should be equal amount of each type. On the other hand, if they are linked, they're located on the same chromosome, then body color and wing shape go together when chromosomes move around. Remember that in meiosis, it's not individual genes that get moved around, it's chromosomes. And all of the genes on that one chromosome go wherever the chromosome goes. Therefore, the expected ratio, if they are linked, is 1 to 1 to 0 to 0. You shouldn't be able to get these last two boxes. This brings up another definition, by the way. Notice that two of these possible zygote types, the first two in the Punnett square, are like one or the other parent exactly. This one is like this parent, this one's just like this parent. And therefore, we call these ones parental types, because they're like one parent or the other, when all we're paying attention to is these two characteristics. These third and fourth zygotes, though, aren't like either parent. This one's like one parent for body color and like the other parent for wing shape, and this one as well. So these ones, the non-parental types, get their own name. Those are called recombinant types, because they involve a recombination of alleles from the two parents into something new. Okay, so any given zygote is either a parental type or a recombinant type. But what it says here is that if genes are not linked, you should have all four possibilities. You'd have parental and recombinants possible. If they are linked, you shouldn't have any recombinants. You should only have parentals. And remember, it's one or the other. One of these has to be true. Either the genes are linked or they aren't. But look at the real results here. Neither of these two predictions came true, even though one of them has to be a correct hypothesis. The real numbers are that you got about the same number of parental types as each other, almost 1,000 each, but you got not nearly as many recombinant types. Well, the fact that you got the fact that you didn't get an equal number of them means that there must be something wrong with this first one. You just respect, I mean, yes, if you have four offspring, it might work. But when you're doing this many offspring, you'd expect it to fall right in line, one to one ratio. It's not a one to one ratio, though. It's much more likely to get parental types. And so what is going on here? How is it that you can get recombinant types, which involves the body color allele separating from the wing-shaped allele, even though they're on the same chromosome? Exactly. Crossing over explains why this is possible. Because if crossing over happens, then two genes that are on the same chromosome can be separated from each other and go to opposite cells. Okay, we can see this in slide 9, which explains this, looking at the chromosomes. Hopefully the chromosome pictures will help you understand it. So this is not the parental, this is the F1 female. She's already a heterozygous individual, but notice that these are linked genes, which is why we're only looking at one chromosome here. There's two of them because it's a diploid, but it's one chromosome. We're ignoring all the others. And the two black marks shows you that these two genes are on the same chromosome. They are linked. All right. So B plus and VG plus you would expect to go together. B and VG you would expect to go together because they're riding on the same ship. But if crossing over occurs, then they can be separated. But it's not just that crossing over would have to occur. Crossing over occurs randomly, right? Anywhere along the length, basically, crossing over can happen. The chiasma, the crossover point, can occur anywhere along the length. Well, if it occurs anywhere to the left of this B gene, it wouldn't matter. And if it occurs anywhere to the right of the VG gene, it wouldn't matter. Right? You cross it over here and you swap those, it doesn't affect the two genes that are on the same chromosome, right? They're still going to be together. So not only do you have to have crossing over, but the chiasma, which randomly occurs, has to occur between the two loci. The two loci is the plural of locus, the two positions of those genes. And if that happens, then the swapping will separate the B from the VG and put them into separate chromosomes, which will go to opposite cells. That all make sense? Well, here we have the same Punnett square we looked at before, just showing you the chromosomes instead of the flies. And these are real numbers. And before we had the ability to just easily look at DNA, a graduate student in a genetics lab figured out mathematically that what the ratio is of the parental types versus all of them can tell you valuable information about where the gene loci are. He called this the recombination frequency, which is really just the sum of all the recombinant types, which in this case is 206 plus 185. That's where the 391 comes from. Divided by the total number of offspring, which is all four numbers added together. That's where the 2300 comes from. And then you just multiply by 100 to express it as a percentage. Well, in this case, it's 17% recombination frequency. All right. And what he figured out is that the lower that recombination frequency is, the rarer the recombinants are, in other words, the closer together the two genes must be. Because the closer their loci are to each other on that chromosome, the more unlikely it is that a randomly occurring chiasma in crossing over will occur between those two positions. Does that make sense? And so this was valuable information because it allowed for what's called gene mapping. It's a lot of work to go through, but this was in the days before you could actually get in there and sequence DNA. So we knew that the genes were on the same chromosome because of how the Punnett squares worked, but that doesn't at all tell you where the genes are, and that's valuable information in these early days. So you do these crosses over and over, But each cross, you pay attention to two characteristics of several. In this case, there are three characteristics, three genes being studied. Well, you'd have to do one across for the B and the CN, see what those recombination frequencies are, the CN and the VG, calculate that recombination frequency, and then B and VG, and calculate that recombination frequency. That's where these percentages came from. So the fact that B and VG give 17%, and the others give about 9%, tells you that this CN gene must occur between the other two. And similarly, the greater the recombination frequencies, the farther the two genes are from each other. So this doesn't tell you exactly where they are, but it tells you where they are relative to each other if you go through all the work. Slide 11 just shows you more and more genes once you add more information to the database, doing more and more crosses. And these numbers here are just relative to this gene that's on the end. So 0 just means we're starting here, and these are relative distances from that end. Well, we wouldn't bother to do this nowadays because we can just sequence the DNA, but this was valuable at the time. Slide 12 is a little change in direction. Hopefully you remember meiosis, and what happens in meiosis, as in mitosis, is that in one part of it there is a separation, right? Things line up first, but then they separate. Well, meiosis has two separation events. There's anaphase 1 and anaphase 2. And what separates is different in those two, of course, as we've discussed. But the point is that for things to go normally, there has to be separation. And another word for separation is disjunction, which is just the noun form of disjoin. Disjoin means to separate. So disjunction is the normal thing, and it usually happens without a hitch, but not always. Sometimes things that are supposed to separate actually don't end up separating. And when that occurs, we call it non-disjunction. Okay? Non-disjunction is an error. And it's an error that leads to an abnormal ploidy. All right? So I'll give you another couple definitions involving ploidy. A cell that has the correct or normal number of chromosomes is called a euploid cell. That's the adjective, or you could call that condition of having the normal number euploidy. All right, that's the normal situation. Any abnormal number of chromosomes, however it happens, is the opposite of this, so we call it aneuploidy. Well, what we see in this 12th slide is that non-disjunction, if it happens accidentally, leads to aneuploidy. And it doesn't matter whether the non-disjunction happens in meiosis 1 or in meiosis 2. Either way, there are going to be aneuploid cells that are created. But look at it happening here in meiosis 1. The disjunction happens in, this is an N of 2 for simplicity. In this type of chromosome, nothing wrong happens. But in the chromosome number 1, because it's the bigger one, there is non-disjunction happening. What that means is one of the two daughter cells is going to get all of the tetrad, both homologs. The other one's not going to get either homolog. So right away, both of these daughter cells are already aneuploid. Right? This one has too many chromosomes, this one has too few. And both of those conditions lead to problems. Which would you say is the worst problem to have? Too few chromosomes or too many? Too few, because you are totally missing a bunch of genes, right? Which means you cannot make any of those proteins, which means you probably won't survive. It's possible to survive having too many chromosomes, but that causes problems as well. Well, both of these are aneuploid cells, and that doesn't mean they can't go on to meiosis 2. But even if it happens normally, since you started with aneuploid cells, all four of these are going to be aneuploid. On the other hand, on the right, if you have meiosis one go off correctly, and then one of those two daughter cells has non-disjunction, that means that two of the four gametes being produced will be euploid. The other two will be aneuploid. One will have too much and one will have too many and too few chromosomes. Okay, 13. So we're revisiting mutation here. We've talked about mutations already, but when we were talking about mutations before, with all the examples I gave you and the categories and whatnot, the frame shifts and stuff, that was all point mutations, or at least very small scale mutations. A point mutation is a single nucleotide pair, but there could have been three or four pairs. In other words, it's not a very big mutation in terms of the overall length of the sequence affected. Here, though, we're looking at chromosomal mutation, which is a much larger scale change in sequence. Each of these chromosomes has letters associated with it, but these letters do not represent genes. Each letter represents a certain length of the chromosome, but it's much bigger than a gene. The A region might have hundreds of genes in it, or at least dozens. B has dozens of its own, and so on. So these are very large-scale changes that are occurring in chromosomal mutation. And there are different categories. Deletion first. So this deletion means you're removing something. In this case, the D section gets removed accidentally. So what was A, B, C, D, E, F, G now becomes A, B, C, E, F, G, H. Well, these large-scale mutations cause much larger-scale problems, right? A point mutation will affect a single protein. A chromosomal mutation affects multiple genes and sometimes eliminates those genes, so including deletion, which eliminates however many genes are in that D region, which is going to be a very big deal, hard to survive because you're missing the information for how to make all of those proteins. Duplication means something gets copied. So A, B, C, D, E becomes A, B, C, B, C again, then the rest of it. Well, this one is much easier to survive. And in fact, we look at the genome, and there's evidence that this happens fairly often. Because you're not taking anything away. You still have all the normal genes in there, but now you have some extra copies of some genes. And as long as that doesn't interfere with the normal production of the genes to begin with, this extra set that you have is not really necessary, and therefore it's kind of like a laboratory. Mutations can happen in those without actually taking a chance that something will go wrong because you still have the original copies, and therefore it might be that eventually changes will be made that will give you better versions of corresponding proteins. But that's duplication. Inversion refers to flipping around. Invert means turn over. So A, B, C, D, E becomes A, D, C, B, E. Well, here you don't have any addition or subtraction of material. It's the same size chromosome, but now it's in a different order. And there's a couple of problems with this. One is that wherever these breaks occur, might occur right in the middle of a gene, so that would destroy that gene, right, which is problematic. But it's actually unlikely because of what I've told you before. Most of the DNA is in spaces between genes, so that's where it's most likely to have a cut occur. Even if there doesn't destroy a gene, though, having the gene intact but in a different position on the chromosome might affect its ability to be transcribed, to get turned on or turned off. Because part of the job of these non-coding sequences that make up 99% of your DNA is to allow for the control of the regions that are genes. And so it might turn a gene on permanently, which would be bad, or turn one off permanently, even though the genes are there. you just don't know. It depends on how it happens. But that's inversion. And the most complex of the ones listed here is the bottom one, reciprocal translocation, because this involves two different chromosomes. A section gets broken off of each, and then they end up getting hooked on to the other one that they're not supposed to be part of. So AB becomes part of this chromosome, and MNO becomes part of the first one. Well, once again, you still have genes, but now they're in the wrong place, so that can affect whether they are controlled properly. And also, once again, the break lines might destroy a gene if it occurs right in the middle of a gene somewhere. Those are just general schemes. 14 gives you an actual example. This is a reciprocal translocation that happens fairly often compared to others for whatever reason. I don't really know what causes it to be likely. But it involves chromosomes 9 and 22, and that leads to this abnormal 22, which is called the so-called Philadelphia chromosome, that's one way that leukemia can form. One in every 10,000 or 100,000 people actually has this happen. So it's fairly, it's not just totally random. Some of them, for some chemical reason, are more likely than others. Okay, and 15, this is a slide I don't want to spend too much time on, but it is, I just wanted to give it to you because it introduces the idea of epigenetic effects. If we change genes, whether it's mutation when mutation happens, that's directly a change to a gene. So obviously that's going to have effect on phenotype, right, as we've discussed. But there can also be epigenetic changes that occur that affect phenotype. Epigenetic really means on the genes, but not actually affecting the genes. Like the epidermis is on the dermis, for instance, same prefix. So epigenetic effects do not change the DNA sequence, but they change the expression of the genes. And there's all kinds of different epigenetic effects. This is just one example, which is called genomic imprinting. Well, first of all, genome, which genomic is an adjective of, the genome refers in any given organism to the entire DNA library that this individual has. Genomic imprinting is a type of epigenetic effect in which one chromosome or the other, well, one of the two chromosomes in the diploid individual and not necessarily the entire chromosome, I shouldn't say it that way, but at least a single gene gets turned off for the entire lifetime of that individual. Very similar to X chromosome inactivation, except it can happen on autosomes, and it doesn't change the gene, it's still there, it just becomes inaccessible because of extensive methylation. Remember back in the functional groups discussion, I said that methylation is a way to turn DNA off in a region. So that's how this happens. And it's made permanent. So once a cell has a imprinted gene, that same gene will be turned off in all the cells it becomes for the entire lifetime of the organism. And then it gets reset between generations. It's not permanent for the species, it's just permanent for the individual. But this has an effect for heterozygotes because it depends on which one gets turned off. And imprinting usually happens in one sex it happens based on whether it came from the one parent or the other. So there are some genes that are imprinted by the mother, the maternal parent, some by the paternal. So this is a wild-type mouse of normal size. It has a paternal chromosome and a maternal chromosome, of course, but this is an imprinted gene. So in this case, only the father's gene remains on in the lifetime of the son, or the daughter, whichever this is. the one that came from the mother gets turned off for the lifetime of this mouse. So this one happened to be the normal allele on the one that gets expressed, therefore this is a normal sized mouse. For a homozygote, it matters as well. In this case, the normal one is expressed. The mutant one is not expressed, therefore it's normal sized. I'm sorry, these are heterozygotes on the bottom. This one is just is flipped. So these two have the same genotype, right? One uppercase, one lowercase in the normal scheme of genotypes. But there's two possible ways to be heterozygous, right? You can get the dominant from the mother and the recessive from the father, or the other way around. Well, in imprinting, it matters, because the father's one's going to be turned on, the mother's one's going to get turned off. And in this case, the mother's one that got turned off was the normal one. So the mutant one makes this a dwarf mouse, even though it has the same genotype as the normal size one. That's why it's epigenetic. It's not due to a difference in the actual DNA sequence. And that means we've reached the end of Bio 181 information. So you now know the basics of cell biology. I hope you do well on the remaining two items. I'll see you downstairs.